women have for men's pleasure. No, it was all too soon to tell whether it would have been a boy or not. But she had had one fine son. I doubt not she would have borne you another, had she been strong enough and young enough to carry it.
Morgaine, dearest, look at me,
Uriens pleaded.
I'm so sorry you are ill. But don't grieve, my darling. I still have two sons. I don't blame you. Oh, you don't, do you?
Said the old midwife, still truculent.
You had better not speak one word of blame to her, Your Majesty. She's still very weak and sick. We will have another bed put in here, so she may sleep in peace till she's quite well again. Here.
And Morgaine felt a comforting woman's arm under her head. Something warm and comforting held to her lips.
Come, dear, drink this now. It has honey in it, and medicines to keep you from bleeding any more. I know you're sick, but try to drink it anyhow. There's a good girl.
Morgaine swallowed the bittersweet drink, tears blurring her vision. For a moment it seemed that she was a child, but Igraine held her and comforted her in some childish sickness.
Mother, she said.
And even as she spoke, knew it was delirium, that Igraine had been dead for half a lifetime, that she was no child or maiden, but old, old, too old to lie here in this ugly way and so near death.
No, Your Majesty, she doesn't know what she's saying. There, there, dear, you just lie still and try to sleep. We've got hot bricks on your feet, and you'll be warm in a minute.
Soothed, Morgaine floated away into dream. Now it seemed that she was a child again in Avalon, in the House of Maidens, and that Vivian was speaking to her, telling her something she couldn't quite remember, something of how the goddess spun the lives of men, and she handed Morgaine a spindle and bade her spin. But the thread wouldn't come smooth, but tangled and knotted, and at last Vivian, angry with her, said, "Here, give it to me." And she handed over the broken threads and the spindle. Only it wasn't Vivian either, but the face of the goddess, threatening. And she was very small, spinning and spinning with fingers too small to hold the distaff. And the goddess bore the face of Igraine. She came to awareness a day or two later, cool-headed, but with a vast and empty ache in her body. She laid her hands over the soreness and thought grimly, I might have saved myself some pain. I should have known that I was ready to miscarry anyway. Well, done is done. And now I must ready myself to hear that Arthur is dead. I must think what I will do when Accolon returns. Guinevere shall go into a nunnery, or if she wishes to go beyond the seas to Les Britain with Lancelot, I will not stop them. She rose and dressed herself, made herself beautiful.
You should keep your bed, Morgaine. You are still so pale, said Uriens.
No, there are strange tidings coming, my husband, and we must be ready for them, she said, and went on braiding her hair with scarlet ribbons and gems. Uriens stood at the window and said,
Look, the companions are practising their military games. Owain, I think, is the best rider. Come, my dear, does he not ride as well as Gawain? And that is Galahad at his side. Morgaine, don't grieve for the child you lost. Owain will always think of you as his mother. I told you when we were wedded, I would never reproach you for barrenness. I would have welcomed another child, but since it was not to be, well, we have nothing to grieve for. And, he said shyly, taking her hand, perhaps it is better so. I did not realize how near I had come to losing you.
She stood at the window, his arm about her waist, feeling at one and the same time a feeling of revulsion and a gratitude for his kindness. He need never know, she thought, that it had been Accolon's son. Let him take pride that in his old age he could father a child.
Look, said Uriens, craning his neck to see further. What is that coming through the gate?
A rider, together with a monk in a dark habit on a mule, and a horse bearing a body. Come, she said, pulling at his hand. We must go down now. Pale and silent, she moved at his side into the courtyard, feeling herself tall and commanding, as befitted a queen. It seemed that time stopped, as if they were again in the fairy country. Why was not Arthur with them, if he had triumphed? But if this was Arthur's dead body, where was the ceremony and pomp on the death of a king?
Uriens reached to support her with his arm, but she thrust it away and stood clinging to the wood-framed door.
The monk put back his hood and said,
Are you Queen Morgaine of Wales?
I am, she said.
I have then a message for you, he said. Your brother Arthur lies wounded in Glastonbury, nursed by the sisters there. But he will recover. He sends you this,
he waved his hand at the shrouded figure on the pack-horse,
as a present, and he bid me say to you that he has his sword Excalibur and the scabbard.
And as he spoke, he twitched away the pall covering the body, and Morgaine, all the strength in her body running out of her like water, saw Accolon's sightless eyes staring at the sky. Uriens cried out, a great cry like death. Owain thrust his way through the crowd around the steps, and as his father fell, stricken, across the body of his son, Owain caught and supported him.
Father, dear father!
Ah, dear God, Accolon,
he said with a gasp, and stepped toward the horse where Accolon's body lay.
Gawain, my friend, give my father your arm. I must see to my mother. She is fainting.
No, said Morgaine. No.
She heard her own voice like an echo, not even sure what she wanted to deny. She would have rushed to Accolon, flung herself on his body, shrieking in despair and grief. But Owain held her tight. Guinevere appeared on the stairway. Someone explained the situation to her in a whisper, and Guinevere came down the steps looking at Accolon.
He died in rebellion against the High King, she said clearly. Let there be no Christian rites for him. Let his body be flung to the ravens, and his head hung on the wall as a traitor.
No, oh no,
cried out Uriens, wailing.
I beg of you, I beg, Queen Guinevere. You know me, one of your most loyal subjects, and my poor boy has paid for his crimes. I beg you, lady. Jesus too died a common criminal between thieves, and even for the thief on the cross at his side there was mercy. Show the mercy he would have shown.
Guinevere seemed not to hear. How does my lord Arthur?
He is recovering, lady, but he has lost much blood, said the strange monk. Yet he bade you have no fear. He will recover.
Guinevere sighed. King Uriens, she said, for the sake of our good knight Owain, I will do as you wish. Let the body of Accolon be borne to the chapel, and there laid in state. Morgaine found her voice to protest. No, Guinevere. Lay him in earth decently, if you can find it in your heart to do so much. But he was no Christian. Do not give him Christian burial. Uriens is so filled with grief he knows not what he says.
Be still, mother, said Owain, gripping her shoulder hard. For my sake and my father's, bring no scandal here. If Accolon served not the Christ, then has he all the more need of God's mercy against the traitor's death he should have had.
Morgaine wanted to protest, but her voice wouldn't obey her. She let Owain guide her indoors, but once within the door she threw off his arm and walked alone. She felt frozen and lifeless. Only a few hours gone, it seemed to her, she had lain in Accolon's arms in the fairy country, had belted the sword Excalibur at his waist, Now she stood knee-deep in a relentless tide, watching it all swept away from her again, and the world was filled with the accusing eyes of Owain and his father.
"Aye, I know it was you who plotted this treachery," said Owain. "But I have no pity for Aquilon, who let himself be led astray by a woman. Have decency enough, mother, not to drag my father any further into your wicked schemes against our king."
He glared at her, then turned to his father, who stood as if dazed, clutching at some piece of furniture. Owain put the old man into a chair, knelt, and kissed his hand.
"Father dear, I am still at your side."
"Oh, my son, my son,"
Uriens cried out, despairing.
"Rest here. Father, you must be strong," he said. "But now, let me care for my mother. She is ill, too."
"Your mother, you call her?"
Uriens cried out, starting upright and staring at Morgaine with implacable wrath.
"Never again let me hear you call that abominable woman mother. Do you think I know not that by her sorcery she led my good son into rebellion against his king? And now I think by her evil witchcraft she must also have contrived the death of Avaloch. Aye, and of that other son she should have borne to me. 3 sons of mine has she sent down into death. Look out that she does not seduce you and betray you with her witchcraft into death and destruction. No, she is not your mother."
"Father, my lord," Owain protested, and held out a hand to Morgaine.
"Forgive him, mother. He doesn't know what he's saying.
You are beside yourselves with grief, both of you.
I beg you in God's name to be calm. We have had enough grief this day."
But Morgaine hardly heard him. This man, this husband she had never wanted. He was all that was left of the wreck of her plans. She should have left him to die in the fairy country. But now he was doddering around in the fullness of his useless old life. And Aquilon was dead. Aquilon, who sought to bring back all that his father had pledged and forsworn, all that Arthur had vowed to Avalon and forsaken. And nothing was left but this ancient dotard. She snatched the sickle knife of Avalon from her girdle and thrust away Owain's restraining arms. Rushing forward, she raised the dagger high. She hardly knew what it was she meant to do as it flashed down. An iron grip caught her wrist, wrenching at the dagger. Owain's hand came near to breaking her wrist as she struggled.
"No, let it go. Mother," he pleaded.
"Mother, is the devil in you?
Mother, look, it is only father.
Ah, God, can you not show some pity for his grief? He does not mean to accuse you. He is so miserable he doesn't know what he's saying. In his right mind he will know that what he says is wild nonsense."
"I do not accuse you either.
Mother, mother, listen to me. Give me the dagger. Dear mother."
The repeated cries of "Mother," and the love and anguish in Owain's voice, finally reached down through the mist that blurred Morgaine's eyes and mind. She let Owain wrench away the little knife, noticing, as if from 1,000 leagues away, that there was blood on her fingers where the razor edge of the sickle had cut her as they struggled. His hand was cut too, and he put his finger in his mouth and sucked at it as if he had been 10 years old.
"Father dear,
forgive her,"
Owain begged, bending over Uriens, who lay white as death.
"She is distraught. She loved my brother too.
And remember how ill she has been. She shouldn't have left her bed today at all.
Mother, let me send for your women to take you back to bed."
"Here, you will want this," he said,
pressing the sickle back into her hand.
"I know you had it from your own foster mother, the Lady of Avalon. You told me that when I was just a little boy."
"Ah, poor little mother," he said, encircling her shoulders with his arms. She could remember when she had been taller than he, when he was a thin little boy with bones as small and green as a bird's. And now he towered over her, holding her gently against him.
"Mother, dearest, my poor little mother, come now, come, don't cry. I know you loved Accolon just as you loved me. Poor mother."
Morgaine wished that she could cry indeed, that she could let all this terrible grief and despair rush out of her with tears, as she felt Uwain's hot tears falling on her own forehead.
Uriens, too, stood weeping, but she stood tearless and cold. The world seemed all grey, crumbling at the edges, and everything she looked on seemed to take on some giant menacing shape, and yet to be very small and far away, as if she could pick it up like a toy. She dared not move, lest it should fall to bits at her touch. She hardly knew it when her women came. They took her stiff and unresisting body and lifted her and carried her to bed. They took off the queenly crown and the gown she had put on for her triumph. And distantly she knew that her shift and underlinen was soaked again with blood, but it seemed not to matter. A long time after, she came to herself, and knew that she was washed and clean, and dressed in a clean shift, and lying in bed beside Uriens, with one of her women drowsing on a stool at her side. She raised herself a little, and looked down at the sleeping man, his face sunken and reddened with weeping, and it was as if she looked on a stranger. Yes, he had been good to her, in his own way.
But now that is all past, and my work in his land is done.
I will never see his face again while I live, nor know where he lies in death. Accolon was dead, and her plans in ruins. Arthur still bore the sword Excalibur, and the enchanted scabbard which gave him a charmed life. And since the one to whom she had entrusted that task had failed her, escaping into death where she couldn't follow, then she herself must be the hand of Avalon to strike him down. Moving so silently that she wouldn't have wakened a sleeping bird, she put on her clothes and tied the dagger of Avalon at her waist. She left all the fine gowns and jewels that Uriens had given her, wrapping herself in her plainest dark robe, not unlike the dress of a priestess. She found her little bag of herbs and medicines, and in the dark, by touch, she painted her brow with the dark moon. Then she took the plainest cloak she could find, not her own, embroidered with gold thread and precious stones, but a servant's rough hooded wrap, and stole noiselessly down the stairs. From the chapel she heard the sounds of chanting. Somehow Uwain had arranged this over Accolon's body. Well, it didn't matter. Accolon was free. What did it matter what mummery the priests made with the tenantless clay? Nothing mattered now but reclaiming the sword of Avalon. She turned her back on the chapel. One day she would have leisure to mourn him. Now she must carry on where he had failed. She went silently into the stable and found her horse, managing to bind on the saddle with clumsy hands. She led the animal to the small side gate. She was almost too dizzy to climb into the saddle, and for a moment she sat swaying, wondering if she would fall. Should she wait, or try to summon Kevin to attend her? The Merlin of Britain was vowed to follow the will of the lady. But she couldn't trust Kevin either. He had betrayed Vivian into the hands of those priests who now chanted their hymns over Accolon's helpless body. She whispered to the horse, felt him break into a trot beneath her, and from the foot of the hill turned back to look her last on Camelot. I shall come here but once again in this life, and then there will no longer be a Camelot to which I might return. And even as she whispered the words, she wondered what they meant. As often as Morgaine had travelled to Avalon, she had only once set foot upon the Isle of the Priests. Glastonbury Abbey,
where Vivian lay buried, Andy Grain, too, had spent her last years, was a stranger journey to her than the crossing of the mists into the hidden lands. There was a ferry there, and she gave the ferryman a small coin to row her across the lake, wondering what the man would do if she suddenly rose as she would do with the Avalon barge, and cast the spell that would lead it into the mists and bring it forth in Avalon. But she did not. "Is it only that I cannot?" she asked herself. The air was cool and fresh in the hour just before sunrise. Overhead the sound of church bells was soft and clear, and Morgain could see a long line of grey-robed forms pacing slowly toward the church. The brothers rose early to pray and chant their soft hymns, and for a moment Morgain stood quiet, listening. Her mother and Arthur's lay buried there. Vivian, too, had been laid to rest within the sound of those hymns. The musician in Morgain, always quickly moved, listened to the soft song borne on the early morning breeze, and for a moment she stood motionless, tears burning her eyes. Was she planning outrage on this holy soil? "Let it go. Let there be peace among you, children." It seemed that it was Egrain's forgotten voice murmuring to her. Now all the grey forms were within the church. She had heard much of the abbey here. She knew there was a brotherhood of monks, and at some distance from them, a house of nuns where women dwelt, vowed to be virgins of the Christ till they died. Morgain wrinkled her face in distaste. A god who chose to keep men and women with their thoughts on heaven rather than on this world, which had been given to them for learning and growing in spirit, seemed alien to her. And now that she actually saw men and women mingling this way in worship, with no thought of any other touch or communication, she felt sickened. Oh, yes, there were holy virgins in Avalon. She herself had been secluded that way till the proper time, and Raven had given not only her body, but her very voice to the goddess for her use. There was her own foster daughter, Lancelot's daughter, Nimue, who had been selected by Raven to dwell unseen in solitude. But the goddess recognized that this was a rare choice, not one to be imposed on every woman who sought to serve her. Morgain didn't believe what some of her companions in Avalon had said, that monks and nuns merely pretended holiness and chastity to impress the peasants with their purity, and behind the closed doors of their monasteries did whatever wantonness they would. Yes, she would have despised that. Those who had chosen to serve spirit rather than flesh should do so in truth. Hypocrisy was always disgusting. But the knowledge that they really lived that way, that any force calling itself divine could prefer barrenness to fruitfulness, that seemed to her a terrible betrayal of the very forces which gave life to the world. Fools, and worse, narrowing their lives, and thus wishing to narrow all other lives to their own mean compass. But she mustn't linger here. She turned her back on the church bells and stole toward the guest house, her mind reaching out, calling on the sight to lead her to where Arthur lay. There were three women in the guest house, one dozing beside the door, another stirring a kettle of gruel in the kitchen at the back, and yet a third at the door of the room where, very dimly, she could feel Arthur's presence. He was deep in slumber. But the women in their sombre robes and veils stirred as she came. They were holy women in their own way, and they had something very like the sight. In her presence they could sense something inimical to their lives, the touch, perhaps, of the strangeness of Avalon. One of them rose and confronted her, asking in a whisper, "Who are you, and why have you come here at this hour?" "I am Queen Morgain of North Wales and Cornwall," Morgain said in her low, commanding voice, "and I am here to see my brother. Will you dare to forbid me?" She held the woman's gaze, then waved her hand in the simplest of the spells she had been taught, to dominate, and the woman sank back, unable to speak or forbid her.
Later, she knew, the woman would tell a tale of enchantments and of fear. But in truth, it was no more than this. The simple domination of a powerful will over one which had been given up, deliberately, to submission. A soft light burned inside the room, and by its dimness Morgaine could see Arthur, unshaven, haggard, his fair hair darkened with sweat. The scabbard was lying on the foot of his bed. He must have anticipated some such action on her part. He wouldn't let it out of his reach. And in his hand he held the hilt of Excalibur. Somehow his mind gave him warning. Morgaine was filled with dismay. He had the sight, too, though he looked so fair and unlike the dark people of Britain. He, too, was of the ancient royal line of Avalon, and he could reach her thoughts. She knew that if she reached out to take Excalibur from his hand, he would sense her intent, would wake, and he would kill her. She had no illusions about that. He was a good Christian, or so he thought himself, but he had been set on the throne to kill his enemies, and in some mystical way Morgaine only half understood, the sword Excalibur had grown entangled with the very soul and spirit of Arthur's kingship. If it hadn't been so, if it had only been a sword, then would he have been willing to render it back to Avalon, and had another made for himself, a stronger sword, and a better? But Excalibur had become for him the visible and ultimate symbol of what he was as king. Or perhaps it is the sword itself which has entangled itself with Arthur's soul and kingship, and will kill me of its own will, should I seek to take it from him. And dare I set myself against the will of such a magical symbol? Morgaine started, and told herself not to be fanciful. She laid her hand on her dagger. It was razor-sharp, and she could move, when she must, as swiftly as a striking snake. She could see the small vein in his throat, and knew that if she could cut swift and deep to where the great artery lay beneath it, he would be dead almost before he could cry out. She had killed before this. She had sent Avaloch without hesitation to his death, and not 3 days since she had slain the harmless child in her womb. He who lay sleeping before her was the greater traitor, surely. One stroke, swift and quiet. Ah, but this was the child Igraine had placed in her arms, her first love, the father of her son, the horned god, the king. Strike, fool, for this you came here. No, there has been too much death. We were born from a single womb, and I couldn't face my mother in the country beyond death, not with the blood of my brother on my hands. And for a moment, knowing she moved at the very edge of madness, she heard Igraine calling impatiently, "Morgaine, I told you to take care of the baby." It seemed to her that he stirred in sleep, as if he too heard that voice. Morgaine slid the dagger back into its sheath, reached out her hand, and took the scabbard. This, at least, she had a right to take. With her own hand she had fashioned it. The spells she had woven into it were her own. She hid the scabbard under her cloak and went swiftly out through the thinning darkness to the ferry. As the ferryman rowed her across, she felt the prickling of her skin, and seemed to see, like a shadow, the barge from Avalon. On the far shore they were all around her, the crew of the Avalon barge. Now, quickly, quickly, she must get back again to Avalon. But the sun was rising, and the shadow of the church lay across the water, and suddenly the sun flooded the landscape, and with the dawn a ringing of church bells was everywhere. Morgaine stood as if paralysed. Through that sound she couldn't summon the mists, nor speak the spell. She said to one of the men, "Can you take us to Avalon, quickly?" He said, shivering, "I cannot, lady. It grows harder without a priestess to speak the spell. And even so, at dawn, and at noon, and at sunset, when they ring the bells for prayer, there is no way to cross the mists. Not now.
The spell no longer opens the way at these times. Although, if we wait till the bells are silent, it may be that we can manage to return.
Why, Morgaine wondered, should this be so? It had to do with the knowledge that the world was as it was because of what men believed it was. Year by year, these past 3 or 4 generations, the minds of men had been hardened to believing that there was one God, one world, one way of describing reality, and that all things which intruded on the realm of that great oneness must be evil and of the fiends, and that the sound of the bells and the shadow of their holy places would keep the evil afar. And as more and more people believed this, it was so, and Avalon no more than a dream adrift in an almost inaccessible other world. Oh, yes, she could still call the mists. But not here, not where the shadow of the church's spire lay across the water, and the clamour of the bells struck terror into her heart. They were trapped on the shores of the lake. And now she was aware that a boat was pushing out from the shores of the priest's isle to cross the lake and find her here. Arthur had wakened and found her scabbard gone from him, and now would pursue her. Well, let him follow her as he could. There were other ways into Avalon where the shadow of the church did not prevent her passage. She climbed quickly into her saddle and began to ride along the shores of the lake, circling. She would come at last to a place where, at least in summer, she could cross through the mists. The place where she and Lancelot had once found Guinevere strayed from the nunnery. It wasn't lake, but swampland, and they could get into Avalon by the back way, behind the Tor. She knew that the little dark men were running behind her horse, that they could run for half a day at her horse's tail if they must. But now she heard hoofbeats. She was pursued. Arthur was hard on her heels, and there were armed knights with him. She dug her feet into the horse's side, but this was a lady's horse, not intended for the chase. She slid down her horse's side, the scabbard in her hand. "Scatter," she whispered to the men, and one by one it was as if they melted into the trees and mists. They could move like shadows if they must, and no man alive could find them if they didn't want to be found. Morgaine grasped the scabbard in her hand and began to run along the shores of the lake. In her mind she could hear Arthur's voice, feel his rage. He had Excalibur. She could feel it, like a great shining in her mind, the holy thing of Avalon. But the scabbard he should never bear again. She took it in both hands, whirled it over her head, and flung it with all her strength far out into the lake, where she saw it sink into the deep and fathomless waters. No human hand could ever reclaim it. There it would lie, till leather and velvet rotted, and the silver and gold threads tarnished and twisted, and at last the spells woven into them vanished utterly from the world. Arthur was riding in pursuit, Excalibur naked in his hand, but she and her escort were gone. Morgaine drew herself into silence. A part of shadow and tree, as if some essential part of herself had gone into fairy. While she stayed there, motionless, covered in the silence of a priestess, no one from the mortal world could see so much as her shadow. Arthur shouted her name. "Morgaine! Morgaine!" A third time he called, loud and angry, but the very shadows were still. And at last, confused from riding in circles, once he came so close that Morgaine could feel the breath of his horse, he wearied and called to his escort. And they came to find him swaying in his saddle, the bandages slowly soaking through with blood. And they led him away the way they had come. Then Morgaine raised her hand, and once again the normal sound of bird and wind and tree came back into the world. Morgaine speaks. In later years I heard the tale of how I took the scabbard by sorcery. and how Arthur rode after me with 100 knights, and I too had 100 fairy knights all round me. And when Arthur's pursuit grew near, I turned myself and my men into ringstones. Some day, no doubt, they will add that when I had done, I called for my chariot with the winged dragons and flew away into faery. But it wasn't so. It was no more than this, that the little people can hide in the forests and become one with tree and shadow. And that day I was one of them, as I had been taught in Avalon. And when Arthur had been taken away by his escort, near to fainting with the long pursuit and the cold in his wound, I said farewell to the men of Avalon and rode away to Tintagel. But when I came to Tintagel, it mattered little to me what they did in Camelot, for I was sick even to death for a long time. I know not, even now, what ailed me. I know only that summer faded and the leaves began to fall while I lay in my bed, tended by the servants I had found there, neither knowing nor caring whether I would ever rise. I know I had a low fever, a weariness so great that I couldn't force myself to sit upright or to eat, a heaviness of mind so great that I cared not whether I would live or die. My servants, one or two of them I recalled from days when I lived there as a little child with Igraine, thought me enchanted, and it may even have been true. Marcus of Cornwall sent to me in homage, and I thought, Arthur Starr rides high. No doubt he believes that I have come here at Arthur's will, and he will not, now, challenge Arthur even for these lands he believes his own. A year ago I might have laughed at this, or even made common cause with Marcus, promising him lands here in return for leading a party of the disaffected against Arthur. And even now it crossed my mind. But with Accolon dead, it seemed to matter nothing. Arthur had Excalibur. If the goddess wished that it should be taken from him, she would have to come and take it herself, for I had failed. I was her priestess no more. I think it was that which hurt me worst, that I had failed, failed Avalon, that she hadn't put forth her hand to help me do her will. The strength of Arthur and the priests and of the traitor Kevin had been stronger than the magic of Avalon. And there was no one left. No one left. No one. I mourned without ceasing for Accolon, and for the child whose life had barely begun before it was ended, cast aside like offal. I mourned too for Arthur, lost to me now, and my enemy. And unbelievably, even for Urien's, and for the wreck of my life in Wales, the only peace I had ever known. I had killed or thrust from me or lost to death everyone in this world I had ever loved. Igraine was gone, and Vivian lost to death, murdered and lying among the priests of their god of death and doom. Accolon was gone, the priest I had consecrated to do that last battle against the Christian priests. Arthur was my enemy. Lancelot had learned to hate and fear me, and I wasn't guiltless for that hate. Guinevere feared and loathed me. Even Elaine was gone now. And Uwain, who had been as my own son, hated me too. There was none to care whether I should live or die, so I didn't care either. The last of the leaves had gone, the fearful storms of winter had begun to beat over Tintagel, when one day one of my women came to me and said that a man had come to seek me. At this season? I looked out beyond the window, where unceasing rain beat down from skies as grey and bleak as the inside of my own mind. What traveller would come through this bitter weather, struggling through storms and darkness? No, whoever he might be, I cared not. Say to him that the Duchess of Cornwall sees no man, and send him away. Into the rain? And a night such as this will be, lady? I was startled that the woman should protest. Most of them feared me for a sorceress, and I was content to have it so. But the woman was right. Tintagel had never failed in hospitality when it was in the hands of my long-dead father, or of Igraine. So be it. I said,
"Give the traveller hospitality fitting his rank, and food, and bed, but tell him that I am ill, and cannot receive him."
She went away, and I lay watching the fierce rain and darkness, feeling its cold breath through the slit of the window, and trying to find my way back into the peaceful blankness where now I felt most like myself. But after a very little, the door opened again, and the woman returned, and I started upright, shaking with anger, the first emotion I'd let myself feel in many weeks.
"I have not summoned you, and I did not bid you return. How dare you?"
"I'm charged with a message for you, lady," she said.
"A message I didn't dare say no to.
Not when one of the High Ones speaks." "He said, 'I speak not to the Duchess of Cornwall, but to the Lady of Avalon, and she cannot refuse the messenger of the gods when the Merlin seeks audience and counsel.'"
The woman paused and said, "I hope I've got it right. He made me say it twice over to be sure I had it all." Now, against my will, I felt the stirrings of curiosity. The Merlin? But Kevin was Arthur's man. Surely he wouldn't have come like this to me. Had he not aligned himself firmly with Arthur and with the Christians? Traitor to Avalon. But perhaps some other man now held that office, messenger of the gods, Merlin of Britain. And now I thought of my son Gwydion, or Mordred, as I suppose I must now think of him. Perhaps this was his office, for he alone would now think of me as Lady of Avalon. After a long silence, I said,
"Tell him I will see him, then."
After a moment, I added, "But not like this. Send someone to dress me." For I knew I was too weak to put on my own clothes. But I wouldn't receive any man this way, weak and ill and in my bedchamber. I, who was priestess of Avalon, would manage to stand on my feet before the Merlin. Even if what he brought was sentence of death for all my failure, I am still Morgaine. I managed to rise, to have my dress put on, and my shoes, and my hair braided down my back and covered with the veil of a priestess. I even painted, after the woman's clumsy hands had twice botched it, the symbol of the moon on my forehead. My hands, I noted it incuriously, as if they belonged to someone else, were shaking, and I was weak enough that I let the woman give me her arm as I crawled down the steep stairs. But the Merlin shouldn't see my weakness. A fire had been built in the hall. The fire was smoking a little, as always here when it rained, and through the smoke I could see only a man's figure seated by the fire, turned away from me, draped in a grey cloak. But at his side stood a tall harp. I couldn't mistake. From my lady I knew the man. Kevin's hair was all grey now, but he dragged his stooped body upright as I came in. "So," I said, "you call yourself still Merlin of Britain when you serve only Arthur's will and defy that of Avalon?"
"I know not what to call myself now," said Kevin quietly,
"save perhaps servant of those who serve the gods, who are all one." "Why have you come here, then?"
"Again, I know not," said the musical voice I had loved so well.
"Save, perhaps, in repayment of some debt laid down before these hills were raised, my dear." Then he raised his voice to the serving woman.
"Your lady is ill. Get her to a seat."
My head was swimming, and a grey mist seemed to waver around me. The next thing I knew, I was seated by the fire across from Kevin, and the woman was gone. He said,
"Poor Morgaine. Poor girl."
And for the first time since Accolon's death had turned me to stone, I felt that I could weep, and clenched my teeth against the weeping, for if I shed one tear,
I knew that everything within me would melt, and I would cry and cry and cry, and never cease crying until I melted into a very lake of tears. I said tightly, clenched, "I am no girl, Kevin Harper, and you have won your way to my presence falsely. Now, say what you will say, and go your way." "Lady of Avalon, I am not," I said, and remembered that the last time I saw this man I had driven him from my presence, shrieked at him, called him traitor. It seemed not to matter. Perhaps it was fate that two traitors to Avalon should sit here before the fire, for I too had betrayed my oath to Avalon. How dared I judge Kevin?
"What then are you?"
he asked quietly. "Raven is old and silent now for years. Ninian will never have the power to rule. You are needed..." "When last we spoke," I interrupted him, "you said Avalon's day was done. Why then should there be any to sit in Vivian's place, except a child half fitted for that high office, waiting for the day when Avalon fades forever into the mists?" I felt a scalding bitterness in my throat.
"Since you have forsaken Avalon for the banner of Arthur, will it not make your task easier if none reigns in Avalon, save an ancient prophetess and a powerless priestess? Ninian is Gwydion's love and his creature," said Kevin. "And it comes to me that your voice and your hands are needed there. Even if Avalon is fated to pass away into the mists, will you refuse to pass with it? I never thought you a coward, Morgaine."
And then he raised his eyes to mine and said,
"You will die here, Morgaine, die of grief and exile."
I turned my face away and said, "For that I came here." And for the first time I knew indeed that I had come here to die. "All I have tried to do is in ruin. I have failed. Failed.
It should be your triumph, Merlin, that Arthur has won."
He shook his head.
"Ah, no, my dear. No triumph," he said. "I do what the gods have given me to do, no more. And you do the same. And indeed, if your doom shall be to see the end of the world we have known, why then, my dearest love, let that doom find us each in our appointed place, serving what our God has given us to serve. It is laid on me to recall you to Avalon, Morgaine. I know not why. My task would be simpler with only Ninian there. But, Morgaine, your place is in Avalon, and mine where the gods shall decree. And in Avalon you can be healed."
"Healed?" I said it in contempt. I didn't care. Kevin looked at me sadly.
"My dearest love," he had called me.
It seemed to me now that he was the one person alive who knew me as I was. Before every other person alive, even Arthur, I had worn a different face, seeking always to appear older and better than I was, even to Vivian, that she might find me more worthy to be a priestess. For Kevin, I was Morgaine, thus, and no other. It came to me that even if I stretched forth my hand to him as the death crone, he would see nothing but my own face. Morgaine. I had always felt that love was other than this, was that burning I had felt for Lancelot, for Accolon. For Kevin, I had felt little save for that detached compassion, friendship, kindness. What I had given him had meant but little to me, and yet he alone had taken thought to come to me, to care whether or no I died here of grief. But how dared he break in upon my peace when I had almost won through to that utter quiet which was beyond life? I turned away from him and said, "No, I could not come back to life again, could not struggle and suffer and live with the hatred of those who had once loved me." If I lived, if I returned to Avalon, I must enter again into a death struggle with Arthur, whom I loved. I must see Lancelot still in Guinevere's prison of love. I had ceased to care. I could endure no further the pain that was in my heart. No, I was here, in silence and peace. And before long, I knew it now, I would pass even further into peace. The dizziness that was near to death was drawing closer and ever closer. And this Kevin, this traitor, would bring me back. I said, "No," again, and turned away, my hands covering my face. "Leave me in peace, Kevin Harper. Hither I came to die. Leave me now." He didn't move, nor did he speak, and I sat very still, my veil over my face. After a little time, surely, now he would arise and leave me, for I hadn't the strength to go forth from him. And I would sit here until I was carried back to my bed by the women, and then I would never rise again. And then, into the silence, I heard the soft sound of the harp. Kevin played, and after a moment he sang. I had heard a part of this ballad, for he had sung it often at Arthur's court, of that bard in ancient times, Sir Orfeo, who made the trees to dance, and the stones on the plain to stand in a ring and dance, and all the beasts of the wood to come and lay themselves at his feet when they should have rent him with their claws. But beyond that, today, he sang the other part of the song, which was a mystery, and which I had never heard before. He sang of how the initiate, Orfeo, had lost her that he loved, and had descended into the afterworld, and had spoken there before the lords of death, and pleaded for her, and was given permission to go into the dark lands and bring her forth. And then he had found her there on the undying plains. And then his voice spoke from the soul, and I heard what seemed my own voice pleading. "Seek not to bring me forth when I am resigned to stay here in death. Here within these undying lands all is at rest, with neither pain nor struggle. Here can I forget both love and grief." The room faded away around me. No longer could I smell the smoke from the fireplace, the chill breath of rain beyond the window. I was no longer conscious of my own body, ill and dizzy where I sat. It seemed to me that I stood in a garden filled with scentless flowers and eternal peace, with only the distant voice of a harp breaking unwillingly through the silence. And that harp sang to me, undesired. It sang of the wind from Avalon, with the breath of apple blossom and the smell of ripened apples in their season. It brought to me the cool freshness of the mist over the lake, and the sounds of running deer deep in the forest where the little folk live still. And it brought me the sun-soaked summer where I lay in the sun beneath the ringstones, with Lancelot's arms round me, and the blood of life rising like sap within my veins for the first time. Then I felt again in my arms the heavy softness of my little son, his soft hair against my face, his milky breath sweet and soft. Or was it Arthur himself in my lap, clinging to me, his little hands patting my cheek? Again Vivian's hands touched my brow in blessing, and I felt myself a bridge between earth and sky as I stretched my own hands forth in invocation. High winds swirled through the grove where I lay with the young stag in the darkness of the eclipse, and Accolon's voice spoke my name. And now, it wasn't the harp alone, but the voices of the dead and the living crying out to me, "Return again, return. Life itself is calling you with all its pleasure and pain." And then a new note came into the voice of the harp. "It is I who calls you, Morgaine of Avalon, priestess of the Mother." And I raised my head,
seeing not Kevin's twisted body and sorrowing features, but where he had stood was someone, tall and shining, a sunlit glory about his face, and in his hands the shining harp and bow. I caught my breath before the god as the voice sang on. Return to life, return again to me, you who have sworn. Life awaits you beyond this darkness of death. I struggled to turn away. It is not the god who can command me, but the goddess. But, said the familiar voice in the silence of that eternity, you are the goddess, and it is I who call you. And for a moment, as if in the calm waters of the Mirror of Avalon, I saw myself robed and crowned with the high crown of the Lady of Life. But I am old, old. I belong now to death, not to life, I whispered. And in the silence, words heard again and again in ritual suddenly came to life from the lips of the god. She will be old and young as it shall please her. And before my eyes, my own mirrored face was again young and fair as the maiden who had sent forth the young stag to challenge the running deer. Yes, and I had been old when Acheron came to me, yet I had sent him forth to the challenge, heavy with his child. And even old and barren, yet life pulsed within me as within the eternal life of the earth and the lady. And the god stood before me, the eternal one who summoned me forth to life. And I took one step, and then another, and then I was climbing, climbing from the darkness, following the distant notes of the harp that sang to me of the green hills of Avalon and the waters of life. And then I found I was on my feet, reaching for Kevin, and he put the harp gently aside and caught me, half fainting in his arms. And for a moment the shining hands of the god burned me. And then it was only Kevin's sweet, musical, half-mocking voice that said, I cannot hold you, Morgaine, as well you know. And he placed me gently into my chair.
When did you last eat, Morgaine?
I cannot remember, I confessed. And suddenly I was aware of my deathly weakness. He called the serving woman and said, speaking in the gently authoritative voice of a druid and a healer,
bring your mistress some bread and some warmed milk with honey.
I raised a hand to protest, and the woman looked indignant. And now I remembered that twice she had tried to coax me to eat with these very things. But she went to do his bidding, and when she returned, Kevin took the bread and soaked it in the milk and fed it to me gently, a few mouthfuls at a time.
No more, he said. You have been fasting too long. But before you sleep, you must drink a little more milk with an egg beaten into it. I will show them what to do. The day after tomorrow, perhaps, you will be strong enough to ride.
And suddenly I began to cry. I wept at last for Acheron lying dead on his pall, and for Arthur, who hated me now, and for Elaine, who had been my friend, and for Vivian, lying dead beneath a Christian tomb, and for Igraine, and for myself who had lived through all these things. And he said again, poor Morgaine, poor girl, and held me against his bony breast, and I cried and cried until at last I was quiet. And he called my women to carry me to my bed. And for the first time in many days, I slept. And 2 days later, I rode to Avalon. I remember little of that northward journey, sick in body and mind. I didn't even wonder that Kevin left me before I came to the lake. I came to those shores at sunset when the waters of the lake seemed to run crimson and the sky was all afire, and out of the flame-coloured water and sky appeared the barge,